in the offense. So, Ms. Heath, could you please tell me how you first came to Barrington?
I was born here.
And, you know, what's the first experience, then, that you remember of Barrington?
Oh, the very first?
Mm-hmm. Do you have a childhood memory or something? Like, you remember going outside to play, or any...
We shared a dog with the neighbors down the street. He was a really cute little dog, and I remember he would come up and visit us for a few days, and then we'd go down to our neighbors for a few days. And I remember playing with him. He was just really cute, little puppy.
So you tell me a little bit about the neighborhood that you grew up in, then.
Okay, I grew up on Summit Street, which was a totally residential street. And several of my classmates grew up there also. Back in those days, we had chickens, and we had a big garden.
Like in the front, like you had a chicken pen?
A chicken coop? A chicken house, yeah, in the backyard. We had a deep lot, and we had rabbits. My dad was forever bringing something home that either curled or crawled or barked or...
did you guys have, like, the animal house, or did everyone on the street have chickens?
Well, there were a number of other people that did. It was pretty common. I was born in 33 in the midst of the Depression. And my dad was out of work at that point. He would do any kind of work that he could to put bread and butter on the table. But we lived in a tiny, tiny little house. There were four of us. I was the caboose of the four children, an older sister and two older brothers. And we lived in a little house that had one bedroom in. A kitchen and a living room, and that was it. And it was little. It's about as big as most people's garages are today. But times were very tough, and we sold some of the eggs to neighbors from our chickens, and the chicken manure went on the garden, and my dad used to go out and get chickens to butcher for a local grocery store. And he and my mom would kill the chickens and they would dress them and sell them to the local grocery store, which had a butcher shop. Totally unacceptable in today's world. But they made enough money to buy their first car that way, and they worked very hard.
Could the car get up Summit Hill?
Oh yeah, and in the wintertime, if there was a good snowfall, Summit Hill would be closed for sledding, and the whole town would come over and sled down Summit Hill, and it was just a lot of fun.
Now, would you guys, I know it's sort of a farm town back then, would you guys go down on the big tires when you sled, or was it?
We had sleds with runners, and even my mom and dad would go sometimes, and my dad would lay down on the sled first, and my mom on top of him, and then I'd be on top of my mom, and on a Sunday afternoon, everybody in town would come over and sled down the hill, and during the week, all the kids would sled down the hill. And I remember one time when one of my brother's friends lost control of his car and his sled went underneath, or he lost control of his sled, and his sled went underneath a car that was parked on the street and a big gash in his head.
Oh.
And my brothers brought him to my house. My mother was always patching up somebody who got hurt. And she cleaned him up and sent him back up to his house after she got the bleeding pretty well stopped. But it made everybody a little bit more careful about where they were going sledding. And on Sundays afternoon, Baker's Lake was a favorite skating place for townspeople. Mm. And they would all come up and build bonfires around the edge of the lake and skate on the ice. It was just small town community fun.
There's still some kids that go out ice skating, but they go a little further back so they don't get seen, but they still go out there. I've gone out there actually. But so then you would have gone to Huff Street?
I went to Huff Street when it was a K through 12 school. And I finished my last 2 years of high school in the new high school, which is a lot smaller than the present one. But it was just built, and I think I was the second class to graduate from it.
And what was that? Was that kind of cool, you know, being at the new high school? Or do you remember being like wide-eyed when you went to it? Or?
I don't know. It was way cool because it was a very long walk from Summit Street to the high school, and there weren't any buses to take kids in town then. So I walked. It was about a mile and a half. Once in a while, a friend's parents would give us a ride in the wintertime. But we loved the new school. It was very impressive to be in it when it was brand new. Working out all of the bugs that didn't work. There was, at that point, there was a lower level, like a basement track, that was used. And they found it didn't really work very well.
What do you mean it didn't work?
The air was not good. And I think they closed that a few years after I was there. And they had an outdoor amphitheater that was going to be for, it was a big scooped out hole in the kind of at the side of the school. And it was supposed to be for assemblies, but it got filled up with water. And so
it became a swimming pool.
They changed their mind on that and filled it in. But it was a good school. We had a wonderful superintendent, Frank Thomas, who really tried very hard to produce quality education for kids in town. And at that point, our school district ran almost to Bartlett, I think.
That big?
Yeah. Because it was all farmland.
Yeah.
There were just farms around the edge of town, and all the way over there was just farms. And it seemed like, okay, that would be a good thing to take in, all of that property. And we found out later that, no, it turned out not to be a good thing, and some of that property was for Maryland School District.
You said, you know, especially the Superintendent Thomas really cared about the education. Was there anything in particular you remember him doing that was, this is really?
Oh, yes. For about 10 years, he would take the graduating seniors on a 2-week trip to Washington, D.C. Now, the classes were small, you have to realize. My class of 51 was the last class that was under 100 people. I think we had 75. But we would work, our class would work all through high school, making money to help fund this trip to Washington, D.C. and from the east. We went by bus, and there were a couple of parents who would drive cars and transport kids, and we'd rotate from the bus to the cars. But it was a wonderful experience for kids, some of whom had never left the state before. We were a little small farm town when I was growing up. And we planned our itinerary, and we had big sales and rummage sales and sold popcorn at basketball games. And We did everything we could to make the thousands of dollars that we needed so that when we actually went on the trip, I think it only cost the students about $90 or $100 each. And this included a $5 a day food allowance that we would get every day or two. Mm. And we stayed in hotels, which for many of us was the first time we'd ever stayed in a hotel. Yeah. But we went to Washington, D.C. and Williamsburg. I remember driving along the Blue Ridge Parkway when it was pretty brand new, and we were all in awe of how beautiful it was.
And especially, yeah, like you say, when it's fresh.
Yeah, yeah. And we went to New York City and to Boston, and then to, gosh, I'm trying to think, where else did we go? And we went to the Baseball Hall of Fame, where's that, Cooperstown? And it was just a grand adventure, and Mr. Thomas went along with every group, every class that went, and opened up a lot of eyes to what was out there that we didn't know about. He was wonderful.
I see, it sounds like a wonderful man.
He was.
Well, let's go back to the animals, actually, because I mm-hmm. makes you laugh. So you had chickens, obviously, and you shared a dog.
We had several dogs and a cat. I remember my dad one time brought home some goose eggs that were fertile goose eggs, and we had some bandy hens that are little tiny chickens. Miniature chickens is what they are, bantams.
Oh.
And one little bantam hen was ready to sit on some eggs, and so he put his goose eggs under her. And here was this little hen with these three great big goose eggs under her. And when they hatched, at night chickens will always huddle under their mother's body. And you can see the little heads peeking out, and they are adorable. Well, by the time they hatched, they were way too big to fit underneath her, and she was very worried about this. She didn't know what to do, and was all upset, and finally she figured out, okay, if they would put their heads under her, they could leave their butts stick out.
Prioritize.
And so I wish I had taken a picture of her, because it was just so cute with these three little goslings under the wings of this little bandy hen. But we always had some kind of a menagerie going on. We had, my dad brought home some guinea hens one time, guinea fowl, which are black and white birds native to Africa. Hmm. They do make wonderful soup. However, they are like watchdogs. And when anything disturbs them at night or during the day, they go, "Help! Help! Help!" It is very embarrassing to come home from a date and get out of the car and have the guinea hens going, "Help! Help! Help!"
Is that the smell test for boys? If they could maneuver around the guinea fowls, you know he was a keeper?
Yeah. but Barrington was a nice town to grow up in. It was small then. And if you didn't know everybody by name, you pretty much knew them by sight, because there were only about 3,000 people in the town then. And they knew you, and they knew your parents. The kids didn't get too far out of line, because there was always somebody that was watching what you were doing. But it was, you know, it was a pretty vibrant little town. We had a couple of like general stores, and we had, I think, 5 hardware stores at one point. And we had an A&P grocery store, the National Tea, and several delis.
I said, Norton Levine likes to, loves to, or is love telling me how they had, used to have 4 grocery stores here in Barrington.
Mm-hmm,
so.
Mm-hmm.
She remembers that. But.
Yeah. She worked at the Village Hall for many, many years.
Many, many years.
Yeah.
So. Okay, so, you know, so you grew up with all these animals. I mean, do you think that kind of pushed you towards what you've done now with the Hammer Project?
Oh, absolutely. Very definitely. Because I know what a difference a flock of chickens can make in a family's ability to feed itself. We would have really had a very, very hard time surviving without our chickens and the garden, because my mother canned everything. The chickens were a source of income as well as food.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, projectively. And we had, you know, we had rabbits, and we knew the rabbits were to eat. They weren't just pet bunnies. They were to eat, and they taste very good.
Yes, I thought Thumper was cute, but he was also good as dinner, too.
Yeah.
Makes sense. So, and like you said, you were obviously born during the Depression,
mm-hmm.
born poor.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, before you graduated high school in 51, did your family manage to sort of, I don't want to say get out of poverty, but, you know, you said they saved up, they got a car and whatnot. Did the family ever move, or did you
no.
grow up in that house?
No, I grew up in that house. We all did. And we are all still alive, and we all still love each other. We always managed to get along. It's pretty much living on top of each other, but and by today's standards, we would probably be classed as deprived. We were not deprived. We had parents who cared about us, and I made sure that we were fed and had clothes. My mother had a sewing machine. And I remember her saying that during the Depression, they had been buying a sewing machine so much per month. And she said that was the only thing we lost. And my father told her, as soon as I get a regular job, the first thing we'll get is another sewing machine for you. Because they couldn't make the payments. And I said, how did you survive? And she said, well, it seemed that whenever one of your kids needed shoes or something for school, a job would open up by the day for your dad, and he would make enough money to get those shoes or what, material for a dress or whatever,
yeah.
whatever it was. And then he got a job as a butcher at the Royal Blue Store, which was right downtown. And then from the Royal Blue, he went to work at the Jefferson Food Lockers, which is where the ice house is now.
Oh.
And there were, this was before the days of home freezers, and so people would buy or raise and had butchered a cow, a steer for beef, or a pig, or chickens, and then they would bring them in and freeze them and store them in their food locker. And there was a butcher shop there that would dress the meat and wrap it and package it and freeze it for the people, and then they would come down, get their key, and go open up their locker and take out whatever they wanted for the week, because refrigerators didn't have big freezers then, and home freezers weren't invented yet.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nice to know that you had food in the freezer that was yours.
Yeah, you count on it.
Yeah, and when When my dad started working there, then we started freezing some of our vegetables from the garden instead of canning them, but we always canned a lot. And used jars as well as the cans from the Berkeley Can Sealer Company that were actually metal tin cans.
Mm-hmm.
And you grind the top shut on them. It was always my job. You grind and grind and grind and grind, make sure you got a good seal. And then pressure cook them.
Yeah, I don't think too many people do that anymore.
No, no, they don't.
Well, I mean, going back a little bit, you talked about the guinea fowls, and it was embarrassing to have a date to find out about this. How did you come to meet your late husband?
Oh, well, we both worked together. Mm-hmm. Working at the town shop was my first job.
Oh, that's right.
And at that point, my husband's brother and his wife owned the shop, and my brother worked for them mostly nights because he was doing construction work during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but that's how we met. And I think I was a freshman when I started working there. And when I was a senior, we started dating. And he always joked, he said, "Oh my God, I had to marry her because she was the best help we had."
So he was working at the, or he was, I'd say he was the senior as well with you then? When you two were working like in high school together then?
No, he was not in high school. He was 11 years older than I was.
Oh, okay, so I wasn't sure. Okay.
And my kids used to say, "Mom, what would you do if we dated somebody who was 11 years older than us?" And I said, "Probably lock you in a closet."
Exactly.
But the age difference never made a difference to us.
Mm-hmm.
We're really very compatible, very good buddies. And we worked together and we played together. And I could never understand women who would say, "Well, I married him for better or worse, but not for lunch," because we always enjoyed our time together. Whether we were home or whether we were traveling, he helped as much at home as I helped at the store. So our kids all worked there growing up, because we had it for 27 years.
Oh, yeah.
And they worked after school on weekends and during the summer. And they went off to college. When they would come home on break, they didn't get to go to Florida. They got to go to the town shop and work so we could go away. Because it was a 7-day-a-week job, 365 days a year, we were always open.
And you remember working at Christmas then?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My husband always went down early Christmas morning because there would be people who forgot to pick up film or batteries, or they needed to get out of the house and have a cup of coffee without the kids. Or they were lonely and single and didn't have any place to go. And we had a lot of those. But he would go down and open up, and usually it only worked until noon on Christmas Day. When the kids were old enough, they would go down and help him too. And they found out that there was something kind of special about seeing people on Christmas morning. And I always used to make plates and plates of homemade fudge that we would have out on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day.
Sounds delicious.
it was good. Everybody liked it. And I made so much of it, I got to the point where I couldn't even stand the sight of it anymore. But I made soup for the store and pies and cookies and we had sandwiches.
It was as much a bakery then as a shop, it sounds
well,
like.
Well, not a bakery, but a lunch counter. And I did something then that I couldn't do now because of the health rules changes, but I cooked everything at home and then took it down to the store. And you can't do that anymore. But it, we didn't make a fortune, but we were able to put our kids through school.
Mm-hmm.
And met an awful lot of very nice people. Heard a lot of stories. All of the basketball and football games would be replayed in the store. And the political news was always discussed, and it was a place where people related to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like you said, it's sort of like where everyone came together, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm.
So. Mm-hmm. Cool. So then, when you finally closed the shop, because you said 27 years that you had the shop?
And we sold it. And we hoped that it would continue on. Unfortunately, it did not. It lasted a few years, but the new owner's style was very different than ours. And we would hear about it constantly. It got to the point where my husband never even wanted to go downtown because somebody said, you know what they're doing in there now?
Oh, yeah. It's almost like a child that
yeah.
grew up differently than you wanted him
yeah.
or her to.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah, I believe it. Did you? I mean, what made you guys sell it then? Were you just getting old enough that you couldn't work anymore?
Well, my husband had 3 bypass surgeries by that time, and our youngest child, our son, had graduated from college, and none of our kids wanted to take over the store. They knew how much work it was, and they said, "No thanks. We'll do something else." And we thought, okay, now's the time to sell. So we did. And we found a lot of people who had no clue as to what went into running a business. One couple said, we'd like to do something in our retirement. And we said, this is not for you.
There is no rest.
That's right.
It never stops.
Yeah. But it was a good family business. The kids learned a lot, and every once in a while, when we are all together, they will still talk about things that happened in the store when they were there and growing up, and say, "Oh, well, you remember that guy? He wore a tan coat, and he always got a coffee with 1 cream and 3 sugars. Remember him?" And the other one will say, "Oh yeah, I remember him." But it was a very good growing up experience for them. They all learned how to deal with people.
Mm-hmm.
Oldest daughter became a social worker, for the last 20 years, she's worked in the library, and it's a librarian. In the Ila Library. Second daughter became a nurse, and she works at Good Shepherd. And our son, the youngest, became a fireman, which he always wanted to be from the time he was this big, and is a paramedic and works at the Cary Fire Department. And all of the Barrington firemen used to come into the store on a pretty regular basis. And they were Andy's heroes. He looked up to all of them, and they would tell him all about the fires that they had fought. And he said, they really were a part of my childhood that made me want to be a fireman.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really neat.
Yeah.
That's really neat. So you sold the store,
mm-hmm.
and you know, your husband's, like I said, had 3 surgeries.
Mm-hmm.
When did you first begin working with the Heifer Project? Did you do it immediately after, or was it some time after, or had you already started working with it when you still had the shop?
No, I was aware of it because our church had been involved in it since 1960. We sold the store in. Let's see, the end of 84. And then I went to work for Sidney Johnson, bookseller, who has since passed away. That was in Barrington on Main Street. And she was one of our customers, and my husband said, you know, we don't want to just sit around in our retirement. We want to do something. He said, I think I'd like to work in a hardware store. And so, and he said, I think you ought to go talk to Sydney about working for her, because he knew I loved to read and loved books. So I talked to Sydney, and she said, oh yeah, I'd love to have you work for me. And he found a job at one of the big hardware stores down Route 12, I forget which one it was now. He was there for about 2 weeks, and he said, I can't stand all these young kids who don't do anything. They just stand around and they disappear. I can't do this. I can't work this way. And so he quit. And I found that I loved working with the books, and I worked for Sydney for about 5 years, with the understanding that when we wanted to go away, I would go, which we did. We started wintering in Tucson, and we would be gone for 2 or 3 months at a time. And those were probably the best years of our lives. We both loved it out there.
Winter is not quite like this.
Winter is not anything like this, we found out. There's a better way to spend winter than shoveling snow. We loved it out there. I still go out. My husband's sister lives out there, and I will go and stay with her. And I have a brother and his wife who live just south of Tucson, and I go down and spend some time with them. And then I go in January. But it was after my husband died that I thought, well, after I'm done writing all the final thank you notes, now what am I going to do? Because by this time the bookstore had closed. I called up the Chicago office of Echo Project and said, do you use volunteers? And they said, we sure do. Come on in. And she said, we're doing a mailing tomorrow. Come on in and help. And so that's how I became involved. Mm-hmm. And realized it was a really good fit. Met some wonderful people. And have traveled with Heifer. My first overseas trip ever was with Heifer Project. Mm-hmm. And we went to Kenya, Tanzania, and Uganda in 1997. When you travel with Heifer, you visit the people who have received the animals that have been donated, and you find how it has changed their lives. And it is a very humbling and a very awesome experience, because the people that you meet will say, well, now that I have my cow, I can send my children to school. I have milk to sell. I have milk to give my children. I can buy school uniforms for them. They can go to school. Or I can put a new roof on my house, or I can make my house bigger because I have this wonderful cow that Heifer Project has provided. I don't know if you're familiar with the story of Beatrice's goat. Beatrice was a little girl in Uganda. She's featured in several of our early videos. And in 97, when we traveled there, one of the things I said I wanted to do was meet Beatrice. Mm-hmm. And she was in boarding school at that time. She was 13. And when she was 9, her family received a couple of goats. Well, one goat, which then had twins. And they had enough goat milk to feed the children. I think there were 6 children. The father had left them to try and find work. But he was gone. But the goat provided them with milk, enough to drink and enough to sell, and pretty soon you know, the wonder of animals is that they multiply. they had a number of goats and lots of milk to sell. And Beatrice was able to go to school. What she wanted more than anything else was to go to school. Beatrice is now, I think, 25. She's graduated from with a master's degree from the Clinton School of Public Service. And she's working in New York City at an NGO with a company that she interned with. And she's just a remarkable young woman. And there is a book written about her called Beatrice's Goat and how it changed her life. Mm-hmm. I'm sure the library has it.
Just for anyone that might listen to this, could you give maybe a 30-second brief synopsis of what the Heifer Project does?
Heifer Project provides farm animals for needy families all over the world. And this will improve their nutrition and give them a marketable income, because we not only provide heifers, and you'd be surprised how many young people don't know what a heifer is today. It's a young cow that has not had its first calf. We provide cows and goats, sheep, pigs, and chickens, and ducks, and geese, and llamas, and alpacas, and rabbits, and bees, tree seedlings, vegetable seeds, anything that will help a family improve their lives. And we work with groups of people, not with individual families. It might be a community group, it might be a church group, or it might just be a group of people who get together and apply to receive some heifer animals. And that process takes about 18 months. And the beauty of the program is that every family who receives an animal promises to pass on the firstborn female offspring to another needy family. And they in turn will do the same. And they in turn will do the same. So that that gift keeps giving and giving and growing and growing.
A ripple. Yeah.
And pretty soon the life of a village has changed because of the livestock that they have received. And when you have received something as valuable as a goat or a cow, and you are then able to show that, you are no longer a totally impoverished person. You become a donor, and you are able to share the wealth that you have. And the people take this very seriously. They sign a contract. They will pass on the first female gift, and they have a ceremony called passing on the gift when the young animals are handed over to the new owners. And it's a very, very moving thing to be a part of. They take it very seriously. When I was in China, we witnessed a passing on the gift ceremony for goats. And the Chinese people were very concerned that they pass on an equal amount of goats as they had received. And so they weighed all the goats before they passed them on. And the goats didn't think much of the idea, but it was very important to the people that they did it that way. And in China, I met we met a young man who had received Heifer Project rabbits. I think he received 40 rabbits, and he became a very successful rabbit farmer.
Rabbits certainly multiply.
Rabbits multiply beautifully, and he took great pains in figuring out what kind of cages made the happiest rabbits, because happy rabbits multiply better than unhappy ones. And it turned out to be a box with just a strip of wire across the front, not a total wire, so that the rabbits could sit up on there with their paws on the top of the fence, in the little screen, and they could meet their rabid neighbors next door. And that was very important to him. But he ended up employing 12 people to help with his rabbits. And he invented a machine that would make alfalfa into pellets, which made it easier to feed the rabbits. Mm-hmm. And when we met him, he would have been required to pass on 40 more rabbits to somebody else. He already passed down 4,000 rabbits, and he set up rabbit raising seminars for people to come and find out how to do this profitably and healthily. And he was shipping 200 rabbits a week to be butchered and processed. He was amazing, just an amazing young man that grasped the idea and ran with it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So now, there's multiple write-ups on you about how much you've done for the project and how much you've raised in terms of donations, both, you know, from the area of Grant and the surrounding areas. What's been the biggest challenge for you in doing that?
We've had 5 quilt auctions, one about every 3 years since I've been volunteering. These were a big challenge, but also a lot of fun because in my other life I'm a quilt auction addict. I go to a lot of quilt auctions all over the Midwest. Amish auctions, Mennonite auctions, Mennonite youth sales. And when my HEPA project director at that time found out that I did that, she said, "Do you suppose we get a quilt auction for HEPA project?" And I said, "Well, I guess so. No reason why we couldn't. I guess maybe I've been going to quilt auction school all these years." And so our first one was in 1997, and then every 3 years since then, we had an auction. We changed locale several times. Our last one was this past November. And we had it in Glenview on November 6th. The time before was also in Glenview, and that was our best one in 07. We cleared over $90,000, which was, that's a lot of cows.
And rabbits.
Yeah. And we were hoping to match that this year, but because of the economy, we didn't quite make it, but we did clear over 65,000. And we had some of the most beautiful quilts we've ever had. And we still have about 50 or 60 that we are selling in different formats. Some we're going to put some on eBay. Some are going to be sold at the Clarendon Hills at my friend's church. This spring, and some we sent off to the World Hunger Auction in Rocky Mount, Virginia, which benefits Heifer as well as some local soup kitchens. Mm-hmm. So these quilts are still out there working for Heifer, and we will help other people with whatever they bring in. It's an amazing project. Because when you see it in action, you realize, oh my gosh, what we do to raise funds for those animals really works. It's successful, it's changing people's lives, it's giving them a way up to take care of themselves. And meeting all of those people is just a wonderful, wonderful experience.
Really?
Yeah. 97 was my first trip with Heifer, and then in 2000 I went to China with Heifer. And in 05, I took my just graduated granddaughter from high school. We went to Zambia with Heifer. And each one was just a wonderful trip. And I was so glad to be able to share that trip with my granddaughter. That was really neat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you've been to Africa, you've been to China, and, you know, you've been, in some ways, you've traveled quite a bit, and you do Winter and Tucson, but you keep coming back to Barrington. It seems like
my
home.
So Barrington's my home.
And will it always be?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah. When I die, my ashes will be scattered in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
We took my husband's ashes out to our favorite hiking canyon and scattered them there, and my kids know that's where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a part of me that always will be in Barrington. So, as well as traveling with Heifer, I have traveled to West Africa with archaeological tours. And West Africa is very different than the eastern part of Africa, where all the game animals are. It's much more desert country. And we went as far as Timbuktu. We were in Mali, and we went up to Timbuktu. And I told my grandson that we were going to Timbuktu. He looked at me in amazement. He said, "Man, is that a real place? I thought it was just something people said." But that was a wonderful trip, and I traveled with archaeological tours to Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan in 04. And then we ended up in St. Petersburg, Russia, which was an amazing experience because we talked to archaeologists that we met along our trip, and they told us, you know, what they found and what they uncovered.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them said, "Oh, we just unearthed a teapot and a few pieces of jewelry, but we haven't cataloged them yet. And so your group may handle them and touch them, because after they're cataloged, you can't touch them."
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was amazing to hold a teapot that was 2,000 years old. And it looked just like it came off the shelf at Macy's. It just looked like a big old teapot. Things haven't changed much. You got a good thing going, you just keep it the same. But they too were amazing trips.
Yeah.
And I went to Guatemala in 97 after my first trip with Heifer. A friend called and said, "I want you to go on this trip to Guatemala." And I said, "Terry, I just got back from Africa. I just took a trip, remember?" And she said, "Yes, I know," but she said, "This is a really important trip. And you'll be going during Holy Week. And it's with a church group. And if you don't feel that it's worth the $1,100 it's going to cost, I will personally repay you the $1,100. And I thought, gee, I've got my shots, I've got my passport. Yeah, maybe God wants me to go to Guatemala. So I went, and it was an amazing, amazing trip. I loved it. I would like to go back there. On a Heifer trip, because Guatemala is one of the places where we do have Heifer projects. We've got quite a few in South America and Central America.
Mm-hmm.
But it was amazing to see their Holy Week festivities and processions and things that the patterns of flowers that they make in the streets with flowers and colored sand. It was really a very, very unusual and different experience. Yeah. The travel bug bit me late, but it bit really hard.
That sounds like it. That sounds like it. Well, that's all I have, actually. You know.
I took